Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David, minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, I was out the 12th Hour in the Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is July 11, 2016, or it is 8-8-2020, and we'll start our first service today with a song entitled, In a Land Where We'll Never Grow Old. I have heard of a land on the far away strand. There's a beautiful home of the soul, built by Yahshua on high, that will never shall die. There's a land where we'll never grow old, never grow old, never grow old, in a land where we'll never grow old, never grow old, never grow old. In a land where we'll never grow old, in a beautiful home where we'll never more roam, we shall be in the sweet by and by. Happy praise to the King, to eternity sing. In a land where we'll never shall die, never grow old, never grow old. In a land where we'll never grow old, never grow old, never grow old. In a land where we'll never grow old. When our work here is done, when the cross crown is won, and our troubles and trials are over, all our sorrow will end, and our voices will blend with the loved ones who've gone on before. Never grow old, never grow old, in a land where we'll never grow old, never grow old, never grow old. In a land where we'll never grow old. Part 4 of the Two Babylons. Alexander Hislop. We're going to get right on into it. We're on Chapter 2, Objects of Worship. Trinity and Unity. Trinity and Unity is the name of the subtitle of this. If there be this general coincidence between the systems of Babylon and Rome, the question arises, does the coincidence stop here? To this, the answer is far otherwise. We have only to bring the ancient Babylonian mystery to bear on the whole system of Rome, and then it will be seen how immensely the one has borrowed from the other. These mysteries were long shrouded in darkness, but now the thick darkness begins to pass away. All who have paid the least attention to the literature of Greece, Egypt, Phoenicia, or Rome are aware of the place which the mysteries occupied in these countries, and that whatever circumstantial diversities there might be in all essential respects, these mysteries in the different countries were the same. Now, as the language of Jeremiah, already quoted, would indicate that Babylon was the primal source from which all these mysteries of idolatry flowed. So the deductions of the most learned historians on mere historical grounds have led to the same conclusion. From Zonaras, we find that the concurrent testimony of the ancient authors he had consulted was unto this effect. For speaking of the arithmetic and astronomy, he says, it is said that these came from the Chaldees unto the Egyptians and thence to the Greeks. For the Greeks, you know, are Jews, the Greek Jews. The Egyptians are Ishmaelites. If the Egyptians and Greeks derived their arithmetic and astronomy from Chaldea, seeing these in Chaldea were sacred sciences and monopolized by the priests, that is sufficient evidence that they must have derived their religion from the same quarter, both Bunsen and Layard and their researches have come to substantially the same result. For the statement of Bunsen is unto the effect that the religious system of Egypt was derived from Asia and the primitive empire in Babel. Layard, again, though taking a somewhat more favorable view of the system of the Chaldean Magi than I am persuaded the facts of the history warrant, nevertheless, thus speaks of that system. Of the great antiquity of this primitive worship, there is abundant evidence in that it originated among the inhabitants of the Assyrian plains. We have the united testimony of the sacred and profane history. It obtained the epithet of perfect and was believed to be the most ancient of the religious system, having preceded that of the Egyptians. Okay, it's Egyptus, E-G-Y-P-T-I-I-S, Vero, and Antiquicorus, Essay, Aristotle's Arctur and Primo de Philosophia. I don't know why I'm reading all of this. This is where he's taking this information from. The identity, he adds, of many of the Assyrian doctrines with those of Egypt is alluded to by Porphyry and Clement. And in connection with the same subject, he quotes the following from Birch on Babylonian cylinders and monuments. The Zoadical signs show unequivocally that the Greeks derived their notions and arguments of the zodiac and consequently their mythology that was intertwined with it from the Chaldeans. The identity of Nimrod and the constellation Orion is not to be rejected. Overoff also, in his learned work on the Eleusinian mystery, has come to the same conclusion. After referring to the fact that the Egyptian priest claimed the honor of having transmitted unto the Greeks the first elements of polytheism, he thus concludes, these positive facts would sufficiently prove, even without the conformity of the ideas, that the mysteries transplanted into Greece and there united with a certain number of local nations never lost the character of their origin derived from the cradle of the moral and religious ideas of the universe. all these separate facts, all these scattered testimonies recur to that fruitful principle which places in the East the centers of science and the civilization. If thus we have evidence that Egypt and Greece derived their religion from the Babylon, we have equal evidence that the religious system of the Phoenicians came from the same source. Macrobius shows that the distinguishing feature of the Phoenician idolatry must have been imported from Assyria, which his classic writers included Babylonia. The worship of the Arcticite Venice, says he, formerly flourished as much among the Assyrians as it does now among the Phoenicians. Now, to establish the identity between the systems of ancient Babylon and Papal Rome, we have just inquired in how far does the system of the papacy agree with the system established in these Babylonian mysteries. In prosecuting such an inquiry, there are considerable difficulties to be overcome. For, as in geology, it is impossible at all points to reach the deep underlying strata of the Earth's surface, so it is not to be expected that in any one country we should find a complete and connected account of the system established in that country. But yet, even as a geologist, by examining the contents of a fissure here and upheaval there and what crops out of it on the surface elsewhere, is enabled to determine with wonderful certainty the order and general contents of the different strata over all the earth, so is it with the subject of the Chaldean mysteries. What is wanted in one country is supplemented in another, and what actually crops out in different directions to a large extent necessarily determines the character of much that does not directly appear on the surface. Taking then the admitted unity and Babylonian character of the ancient mysteries of Egypt, Greece, Phoenicia, and Rome as a clue to guide us in our researches, let us go on from step to step in our comparison of the doctrine and practice of the two Babylons, the Babylon of the Old Testament and the Babylon of the New. And here I have a notice, first, that the identity of objects of worship in Babylon and Rome. The ancient Babylonians, just as the modern Romans, recognized, in words, the unity of the Godhead, and while worshiping innumerable minor deities as possessed of certain influences on human affairs, they distinctly acknowledged that there was one infinite and almighty creator supreme over all. Most other nations did the same. In the early ages of mankind, says Wilkerson in his Ancient Egyptian, the existence of a sole and omnipotent deity who created all things seems to have been the universal belief, and tradition taught men the same notions on this subject, which in latter times have been adopted by all the civilized nations. The Gothic religion, says Mallet, taught the being of a supreme God, master of the universe, unto whom all things were submissive and obedient. For the ancient Icelandic mythology calls him the author of everything that exists, the eternal, the living, and awful being, the searcher into concealed things, the being that never changes. It attributed to this deity a infinite power, a boundless knowledge, and incorruptible justice. We have evidence of the same having been the faith of the ancient Hinduism, though modern Hinduism recognizes millions of gods Yet the Indian sacred books show that originally it had been far otherwise. Major Moore, speaking of Brahma, the supreme god of the Hindus, said, "Of him whose glory is so great there is no image, Veda. He illumines all, delights all, whence all proceeded, that by which they live when born, and that to which all must return, Veda. In the Institutes of Menu he is characterized as he whom the mind alone can perceive, whose essence eludes the external organ, who has no visible parts, who exists from eternity, the soul of all beings, whom no being can comprehend." In these passages there is a trace of the existence of the pantheism, that the very language employed bears testimony to the existence among the Hindus at one period of a far purer faith. Nay, not merely had the ancient Hindus exalted ideas of the natural perfection of Elohim, but there is evidence that they were well aware of the gracious character of Elohim as revealed in his dealings with a lost and guilty world. This is manifest from the very name of Brahma, B-R-A-H-M, appropriated by them to the one infinite and eternal God. There has been a great deal of the unsatisfactory speculation in regard to the meaning of this name, but when the different statesmen in regard to Brahm are carefully considered, it becomes evident that the name Brahm is just the Hebrew Ram, R-A-H-M, with the Dagama, a prefix which is very frequent in Sanskrit words derived from Hebrew or Chaldea. Now, Chaldea is a hybrid version of the Paleo-Hebrew, which is, they call it today, the Armenian Hebrew. But it's Arabic. The Arabs are the ones that created the Chaldean dialect. Nebuchadnezzar was an Arab. His son Belshazzar was an Arab. Obama is antithetical Belshazzar, and he definitely is the president of the Muslim Brotherhood of the world, which is Arab. Ram in Hebrew signifies a merciful or compassionate one. But Ram also signifies the womb or the bowels as a seat of compassion. Now we find such language applied to Brahm, the one supreme Elohim, as cannot be accounted for except on the supposition that Brahm had the very same meaning as the Hebrew Ram. Thus we find the god Krishna in one of the Hindu sacred books when asserting his high dignity as a divinity and his identity with the Supreme, using the following words: "The great Brahm is my womb, and in it I place my fetus, F-O-E-T-U-S, and from it is the procreation of all nature. For the great Brahm is the womb of all the various forms which are conceived in every natural womb." How could such language ever have been applied to the Supreme Brahm, the Most Holy and the Most High Elohim, the divine being before all other gods without birth, the mighty Yahweh, Elohim of the gods, the universal Yahweh. But from the connection between Ram, the womb, and Ram, the merciful one, here then we find that Brahm is just the same as Rahman, the all-merciful one, a title applied by the Turks to the Most High, and that the Hindus, notwithstanding their deep religious degradation now, had once known that the Most Holy, Most High Elohim is also the Elohim of mercy. In other words, that he is a just Elohim and a Savior. And proceeding on this interpretation of the name Brahm, we see how exactly their religious knowledge as to the creation has coincided with the account of the origin of all things as given in Genesis. It is well known that the Brahmins, B-R-A-H-M-I-N-S, to exalt themselves as a priestly, half-divine caste, unto whom all others ought to bow down, have for many ages taught that while the other castes came from the arms and body and feet of Brahma, the visible representative and manifestation of the invisible Brahma, and identified with him, they alone came from the mouth of the creative Elohim. Now we find statements in those sacred books of truth that were once a very different doctrine must have been taught. Thus, in one of the Vedas, speaking of the Brahma, it is expressly stated that all beings are created from his mouth. In the passage in question, an attempt is made to mystify the matter. But taken in connection with the meaning of the name Brahm, as already given, who can doubt what was the real meaning of the statement, opposed though it be unto the lofty and exclusive pretensions of the Brahmins. It evidently meant that he who ever since the fall has been revealed to man as the merciful and gracious one. We know at the same time as the Almighty One who in the beginning spake and it was done, commanded and all things stood fast, who made all things by the word of his power. After what has now been said, any one who consults the Asiatic Researches, Volume 7, 293, may see that it is in a great measure from a wicked perversion of this divine title of the one living and true Elohim, a title that ought to have been so dear to sinful men that all those moral abominations have come that make the symbols of the pagan temples of India so offensive unto the eye of the purity. So utterly idolatrous was the Babylonian recognition of the divine unity that the Yahweh, the living Elohim, severely condemned his own people for giving any countenance unto it. They that sanctify themselves and purify themselves in the gardens after the rites of the Holy One, eating swine's flesh and the abomination and the mouth shall be consumed together. Isaiah 66:17. Oh no. And the unity of only Elohim of the Babylonians, there were three persons, and to symbolize that doctrine of the Trinity, they employed as the discoverers of Layard prove the equilateral triangle, just as it is well known that the Romish Church does at this day. In both cases, such a comparison is most disgrading to the King Eternal, and is fitted utterly to pervert the minds of those who contemplate it, as if there was or could be any similitude between such a figure and him who has said, unto whom will you liken Elohim, and what likeness will you compare unto him? For the papacy, as in some of his churches, as for instance in the monastery of the so-called Trinitarians of Madrid, an image of the triune Elohim, with three heads on the one body. For the Babylonians had something of the same. Mr. Layard, in his last work, has given a specimen of such a triune divinity, worshipped in the ancient Assyria, figure 3, the accompanying cut, figure 4, of such another divinity worshipped among the pagans of Siberia, is taken from a medal in the Imperial Cabinet of St. Petersburg and given in persons in Parsons as Japhet, J-A-P-H-E-T. The three heads are differently arranged in Layard's specimen, but both alike are evidently intended to symbolize the same great truth. Although all such representations of the Trinity is necessarily and utterly debased the conception of those among whom such images prevail in regard to that sublime mystery of our faith. In India, the Supreme Divinity, in like manner, is one of the most ancient cave. This is must be manifest. That's in there. Is one of the most ancient cave temples, is represented with the three heads on the one body under the name of Eco Deva Trimurti, one God, three forms. Okay, so much for that. Now I want to point out something I just read. It said right here that Assyria was one of these that adopted that three in one. But as you know, the Adventist today, as I've shown you, represents the Assyrian yoke today around Yahweh's people. In order to represent the Assyrian yoke, it has to adopt the one main doctrine, and that is the three-in-one doctrine that the ancient Assyria had adopted, which is paganism, which is a lie. So the Adventists, that's the number one thing that they teach today, the Trinity, three-in-one doctrine. Okay, so they got this three-in-one doctrine passed on down to them. That's the reason why they have the title Assyria today, the Adventist. Okay. It says, in Japan, the Buddhists worship their great divinity Buddha, the three heads, in the very same form under the name of Sanpeo Fu. All these have existed from the ancient times. While overlaid with idolatry, the recognition of a Trinity was universal in all the ancient nations of the world, proving how deep-rooted in the human race was a primeval doctrine on this subject, which comes out so distinctly in Genesis. When we look at the symbols and the triune figure of the Layard, already referred to and minutely examine them, they are very instructive. Layard regards the circle in that figure as signifying time without bounds, but the hieroglyphics meaning of the circle is evidently different. A circle in the Chaldea was zero, and zero also signified the sea. Therefore, according to the genus of the mystic symbol of Chaldea, which was to a large extent founded on double meaning, that which to the eyes of men in general was only zero. A circle was understood by the initiated to signify zero, the seed. Now, viewed in this light, the triune emblem of the supreme Assyrian divinity shows clearly what had been the original patriarchal faith. First here is the head of the old man. Next here is the zero or circle for the seed. And lastly, the wings and tail of the bird or dove, showing, though blasphemously, the unity of the Father, comma, seed of the, our Son, comma, no, Father, comma, seed, comma, our Son, comma, and Holy Spirit, period. While this has been the original way in which pagan idolatry had represented the triune Elohim, and though this kind of representation had survived until Senator Cherub's time, other people pronounce that as Sennacherib. That you may be familiar with that term, but the correct pronunciation of the Hebrew on that is Senator Cherub time. Yet, there is evident that Sennacherib was a king of the Assyrians. Yet there is evidence that at a very early period an important change had taken place in the Babylonian notion in regard unto the divinity, and that the three persons had come to be the Eternal Father, the Spirit of God incarnate in a human mother, and a divine Son, the fruit of that incarnation. So they have a picture now, so they have some woodcut diagrams down here on this page, and it shows what we're talking about here. Section 2, the mother and child and the original of the child. While this was the theory, the first person of the Godhead was practically overlooked. And that was as the great invisible, taking no immediate concern in the human affairs, he was to be worshipped through silence alone. That is, in point of faith, he was not worshipped by the multitudes at all. The same thing is strikingly illustrated in India at this day. Though Brahma, according to the sacred books, is the first person of the Hindu triad, and the religion of the Hindostan is called by his name, yet he is never worshipped, and there is scarcely a single temple in all India now in existence of those that were formerly erected to his honor. So also is it in those countries of Europe where the papal system is most completely developed. In papal Italy, as travelers universally admit, except where the gospel has recently entered, all appearance of worshiping the King Eternal and the Invisible is almost extinct, while the mother and the child are the grand objects of worship. Exactly so in this latter respect also was it in ancient Babylon. The Babylonians in their popular religion supremely worship a goddess mother and a son, who was represented in pictures and in images as an infant or a child in his mother's arms, figure 5 and 6. From Babylon, this worship of the mother and the child spread to the ends of the earth. In Egypt, the mother and the child were worshipped under the name of Isis, I-S-I-S, and that's what they call the Islamic State today. Its acronym is Isis, I-S-I-S. And Osiris, in India, even this day, as Isis and Iswara. In Asia, as Sabella and Duos. In pagan Rome, as Fortuna and Jupiter, Pure or Jupiter the Boy. In Greece, as Ceres, the Great Mother, with the babe at her breast, or as Irene, the Goddess of Peace, with the boy Plutus in her arms, and even in Tibet, in China, and Japan, the Jesuit missionaries were astonished to find the counterpart of Madonna and her child as devoutly worshipped as in papal Rome itself. Xing Mu, the Holy Mother in China, being represented with a child in her arms and a glory around her, exactly as if a Roman Catholic artist had been employed to sit her up. Subsection 1, the child in Assyria. For the original of that mother so widely worshipped, there is reason to believe, was Semiramis, already referred to, who, it is well known, was worshipped by the Babylonians and other Eastern nations, and that under the name of Rhea, R-H-E-A, the great goddess mother, it was from the sun, however, that she derived all her glory and her claims to deification. That sun, though, represented as a child in his mother's arm, was a person of great stature and immense bodily powers, as well as most fascinating manners. In Scripture, he is referred to in Ezekiel 8:14,
under the name of Tammuz, but he is commonly known among classified writers under the name of Bacchus, B-A-C-C-H-U-S, that is, the Lamented One. To the ordinary reader, the name of Bacchus suggests nothing more than revelry and drunkenness, but it is now well known that amid all the abominations that attended his orgies, their grand design was professedly the purification of souls, and that from the guilt and defilement of sin, this lamented one exhibited and adored as a little child in his mother's arms, seems in point of fact to have been the husband of Semiramis, whose name was Ninus. Okay. So Laura may be an antypical Semiramis, and her husband would be none other than this antypical Ninus, N-I-N-U-S. That was Rose W. Johnson, by which he is commonly known in classical history, literally signified the sun. And what did Rose Johnson end up saying that he was? We know Tammuz was projected to represent the child of Mother Mary in the Catholic Church. Well, and he's also projected to be this the child of Mother Mary, which was Yeshua himself. And they give the child of Mother Mary, Yeshua, they give him the birthday December the 25th, the same they give the Tammuz. I say, as Semiramis, the wife is worshipped as Rhea, whose grand distinguishing character was that of the great goddess mother. The conjunction with her of her husband under the name of Ninus, or the son, was sufficient to originate the peculiar worship of the mother and son, so extensively diffused among the nations of the antiquity. And this, no doubt, is the explanation of the fact which has so much puzzled the inquirers into the ancient history, that Ninus is sometimes called a husband, and sometimes the son of Semiramis. Isn't this amazing? So how they get the triune saying is that Jesus is very God? Well, here's where they got the concept from. Nimrod, Semiramis, and which was actually Ninus was Nimrod. This also accounts for the origin of the very same confusion of the relationship between Isis and Osiris, the mother and child of the Egyptian. For as Bunsen shows, Osiris was represented in Egypt as at once the son of the husband of his mother, and actually bore as one of his titles of the dignity and honor, the name husband of the mother. This still further casts light on the fact already noticed that the Indian Yahweh Iswara is represented as a babe at the breast of his own wife, Issi, I-S-I, or Parvati. Now, this Ninus, our son born in the arms of the Babylonian Madonna, is so described as very clearly to identify him with Nimrod, Ninus, king of the Assyrians, says Trogus Pompeius, epitomized by Justin, first of all changed the contented moderation of the ancient manners, incited by a new passion, the desire of the conquest. He was the first who carried on war against his neighbors, and he conquered all nations from Assyria to Libya. Okay, now what did I just read here? As they were yet unacquainted with the arts of war. This account points directly to Nimrod and can apply to no other. The account of the Diodorus Siculus entirely agrees with it and adds another trait that goes still further to determine the identity That account is as follows. Ninus, the most ancient of the Assyrian kings mentioned in history, performed great actions, being naturally of a warlike disposition and ambitious of the glory that results from valor. He armed a considerable number of young men that were brave and vigorous, like himself, trained them up a long time in the laborious exercises and hardships, and by that means accustomed them to bear the fatigues of war and to face dangers with the intrepidity, as Diodorus makes Ninus. Okay. The most ancient of the Assyrian kings, and represents him as beginning those wars which raised his power to an extraordinary height by bringing the people of the Babylonian under subjection unto him. While as yet the city of Babylon was not in existence, this shows that he occupied the very position of Nimrod, of whom the scriptural account is that he first began to be mighty on the earth, and that the beginning of his kingdom was Babylon, as the Babel builders, when their speech was confounded, were scattered abroad on the face of the earth, and therein deserted both the city and the tower which they had commenced to build. Babylon as a city could not properly be said to exist till Nimrod, by establishing his power there, made it the foundation and starting point of his greatness. In this respect, then, the story of Ninus and of Nimrod exactly harmonized. The way, too, in which Ninus gained his power is the very way in which Nimrod erected his. There can be no doubt that it was by ensuring his followers to the toils and dangers of the chase that he gradually formed them to the use of arms, and so prepared them for aiding him in establishing his dominion, just as Ninus, by training his companions for a long time in the laborious exercises and hardships, qualified them for making him the first of the Assyrian kings. So what did they do? What did the people make the first king of Israel? King Saul. The first of the Israel's kings, King Saul. Okay, so Ninus was the first of the Assyrian kings. Just like King Saul was the first of Israel's king, and it just so happens that King Saul then would identify with the Assyrian kings. Because he was chosen by the people, he was a fleshly, carnal person, even though he's anointed by a prophet, Samuel, to be spiritual and to be able to prophesy. Yet, Yahweh gave him that ability, he gave him that talent to do both, to act like a prophet and a king and a priest. Maybe not necessarily a priest, but a king. Okay. The conclusions deduced from these testimonies of the ancient history are greatly strengthened by many additional considerations. In Genesis 10:11, we find a passage which, when its meaning is properly understood, casts a very steady light on the subject. That passage, as given in the Authorized Version, runs thus. Out of that land went Fort Asher and builded Nineveh. This speaks of it as something remarkable, that Asher went out of the land of Shinar, while yet the human race in general went forth from the same land. It goes upon the supposition that Asher had some sort of divine right to that land, and that he had been in a manner expelled from it by Nimrod. While no divine right is elsewhere hinted at in the context or seems capable of proof, moreover, it represents Asher as sitting up in the immediate neighborhood of Nimrod, as mighty a kingdom as Nimrod himself, Asher building four cities, one of which is emphatically said to have been great, verse 12, while Nimrod, on this interpretation, built just the same number of cities, of which none is especially characterized as great. Now, it is in the last degree and improbable that Nimrod would have quietly borne so mighty a rival so near him. To obviate such difficulties as these, it has been proposed to render the words out of that land the Nimrod went forth into Asher or Assyria. But then, according unto the ordinary usage of grammar, the word in the original should have been Ashurah, A-S-H-U-R-A-H, with the sign of motion unto a place affixed unto it, whereas it is simply Asher, without any such sign of motion affixed. I am persuaded that the whole perplexity that commentators have hitherto felt in considering this passage has arisen from supposing that there is a proper name in the passage, where in reality no proper name exists. Asher is a passive participle of a verb which in its Chaldean sense signifies to make strong, and consequently signifies being strengthened or made strong. Read thus, the whole passage is natural and easy. Verse 10, and the beginning of his Nimrod's kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh. A beginning naturally implies something to succeed, and here we find it. Verse 11, out of that land he went forth, being made strong, or when he had been made strong, Asher has built Nineveh. Now, you know what this Asher is going to translate into today? It's going to translate into Abraham. I think. Maybe not, but let's go on. Now, this exactly agrees with the statement in the ancient history of Justin. Ninus strengthened the greatness of his acquired dominion by continued possession, having subdued therefore his neighbors, when by an accession of forces, accession of forces being still further strengthened, he went forth against other tribes, and every new victory paved the way for another. He subdued all the peoples of the east. Thus then, Nimrod, or Ninus, was the builder of Nineveh. Okay, this Ninus, then Nimrod or Ninus, was the builder of Nineveh. Nimrod or Ninus. And the origin of the same of that city as the habitation of Ninus is accounted for, and a light is thereby at the same time cast on the fact that the name of the chief part of the ruins of Nineveh is Nimrod at this day. Now, assuming that Ninus is Nimrod, the way in which that assumption explains what is otherwise inexplicable in the statements of the ancient history greatly confirms the truth of that assumption itself. Ninus is said to have been the son of Belus or Bel. And you know what Baal translates into? Baal, B-A-A-L. And Baal is said to have been the founder of Babylon. If Ninus was in reality the first king of Babylon, how could Belus or Baal, his father, be said to be the founder of it? Both might very well be, as will appear, if we consider who was Baal and what we can trace of his doings. If Ninus was Nimrod, who was the historical Bel, B-E-L? He must have been Cush, for Cush begat Nimrod. Genesis 10:8. And Cush is generally represented as having been a ringleader in the great apostasy Well, what did the apostatize from? They apostatized from the Noahic religion, which was the same religion as Adam and Abel and Seth and Enoch.
Okay.
But again, Cush as the son of Ham was Hermes or Mercury, for Hermes is just an Egyptian synonym for the son of Ham. Now, Hermes was the great original prophet of idolatry. For he was recognized by the pagans as the author of their religious rites and the interpreter of the gods. And this distinguished Genesis identifies him with the Babylonian Nebo as a prophetic god. And a statement of Hyginus showed that he was known as the grand agent in that movement which produced the division of Tongzhan. His words are these: for many ages men lived under the government of Jove, J-O-V-E, evidently not the Roman Jupiter, but the Jehovah of the Hebrews. So this is where they get Jehovah from, this Jove. Okay, so the start with a J, and the original spelling would be with a Y, it would be Y-O-V-E. Okay, without cities and without laws and all speaking one language. But after that, Mercury interpreted the speeches of men, whence an interpreter is called Hermeneutus. The same individual distributed the nation. Then a discord began. Here there is a manifest enigma. How could Mercury or Hermes have any need to interpret the speeches of mankind when they all speak one language? To find out the meaning of this, we must go to the language of the mysteries. Puresh in Chaldea signifies to interpret, but was pronounced by old Egyptians and by Greeks, and often by the Chaldees themselves in the same way as Puresh, to divide, Puresh, P-E-R-E-S, to divide Mercury. Then our Hermes, or Cush, the son of Ham, was the divider of the speeches of men. He would seem had been the ringleader in the scheme of building the great city and Tower of Babel. So Ham, the second son of Noah, because of that terrible thing he did after he came out of the ark, was to defile his mother and father. See, this gross, terrible thing that he did when they all got drunk. And as the well-known title of Hermes, the interpreter of the gods, would indicate, had encouraged them in the name of Yahweh to proceed in their presumptuous enterprise, and so had caused the language of men to be divided and themselves to be scattered abroad on the face of the earth. Now look at the name of Belus, or Bel, given to the father of Ninus, or Nimrod, in connection with it. While the Greek name of Belus represented both the Baal and Bel of the Chaldees, these were nevertheless two entirely distinct titles. These titles were both alike often given to the same god, but they had totally different meanings. Baal, as we have already seen, signified, the Lord. But Bel, B-E-L, signified the confounder. Okay. When we read that Belus, the father of Ninus, was he that built or founded Babylon, can there be a doubt in what sense it was that the title of Belus was given unto him? It must have been in the sense of Bel the confounder, And to this meaning of the name of the Babylonian Bel, there is a very distinct allusion in Jeremiah 1:2, where it is said Baal, or Bel, is confounded. That is, the confounder is brought to confusion. So, what happened to our prophet that brought up the close of the Adventist Church, Brother Johnson? And he had the title Bel, meaning he was confounded, and he brought the church to confusion. That church was known to pagan antiquity under the very character of Bel, the co-founder. A statement of the Ovid very clearly proves. The statement under which I refer is that in which Janus, the god of gods, from whom all the other gods had their origin, is made to save himself. The ancients called me Chaos. Now, first, this decisively shows that Chaos, C-H-A-O-S, was known not merely as a state of confusion, but as the god of confusion. And so now you can understand where that word in total chaos today. This is what we just read here. But secondly, who that is at all acquainted with the laws of the Chaldaic pronunciation does not know that chaos, C-H-A-O-S, is just one of the established forms of the name Cush, C-H-U-S, or Cush, C-U-S-H. Oh my goodness. And here we have Nebuchadnezzar that has a spelling of Bush, B-U-S-H, which is an acronym for B-U-C-H, I mean, which is an acronym for George Bush's name, B-U-S-H. Now here we have Cush, C-U-S-H. Ha ha. Okay. So today that would translate into George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr.'s father, Herbert Walker Bush, as being Cush, and Nimrod being antitypical Cush, George Bush Jr. Then look at the symbol of Janus, whom the ancients called Chaos, and it will be seen how exactly it tallies with the doings of Cush when he is identified with Bel, B-E-L, the confounder. That symbol is a club, and the name of a club in Chaldea comes from the very word which signifies to break in pieces or scatter abroad. He who caused the confusion of tongues was he who broke the previously united earth. Okay, so Ham, the second son of Noah, is responsible for creating the different languages today and bringing a curse upon the earth this side of the flood, just like Cain in the beginning. In pieces and scattered the fragments abroad. How significant then as a symbol in the club as commemorating the work of Cush as Bel, the confounder, and that significance will be all the more apparent when the reader turns to the Hebrew of Genesis 11:9. And finds that the very word from which a club derives its name is that which is employed when it is said that in consequence of the confusion of the tongues, the children of men were scattered abroad on the face of all the earth. The word there of used for scattering abroad is hephates, which is the Greek form, becomes hephaes. And hence the origin of the well-known but little understood name of the Hephaestos, as applied to Vulcan, V-U-L-C-A-N, the father of the gods. And if I spend this hour, I'm going to close this service now with a song that I've written entitled A Trip in the Future.
When the moon hides his face behind a cloud every night, and the sun ceases to rise anymore, when the stars be headed for the far distant shore. I'm planning a trip in the future, and tomorrow can't be too soon. Gonna pick out a bright spot up yonder and head for that starry lagoon. Today I'll make believe to leave here. This world, care not for my own. I'm anxious to make that long journey to heaven and to my new home. When the moon has its day behind a cloud every night, and the sun ceases to rise anymore, I'll know that something's wrong, and it won't be there be gone. Shall I be headed for that far?